the thought. Because if he knew, if his father learned Selena had somehow opened a portal... Dorian couldn't stop the ice spreading through him. Sorsha rubbed her arms and glanced at the fire. It was still burning high, but... Shit. He had to go. Now. Sorsha said,
He'd kill her, wouldn't he? That's why you said nothing.
Dorian slowly started backing out, fighting against the panicked, wild thing inside of him. He couldn't stop the rising ice, didn't even know where it was coming from. But he kept seeing that creature in the tunnels, kept hearing Fleetfoot's pained bark, seeing Kaol choose to sacrifice himself so they could get away. Sorsha stroked the length of her dark braid.
And he'd probably kill the captain, too.
His magic erupted. After Sorsha had been forced to wait in the cramped office for 20 minutes, Amethy finally paraded in, her tight bun making her harsh face even more severe.
Sorsha,
she said, sitting down at her desk and frowning. What am I to do with you? What example does this set for the apprentices? Sorsha kept her head down. She knew she'd been kept waiting in order to make her fret over what she'd done, accidentally knocking over her entire work table and destroying not only countless hours and days of work, but also a good number of expensive tools and containers.
I slipped. I spilled some oil and forgot to wipe it up.
Amethy clicked her tongue.
Cleanliness, Sorsha, is one of our most important assets. If you cannot keep your own workroom clean, how can you be trusted to care for our patients? For His Highness, who was there to witness your latest bout of unprofessionalism.
I've taken the liberty of apologizing in person and offered to oversee his future care, but... Amethy's eyes narrowed.
He said he would pay for the repair costs and would still like you to serve him.
Sorsha's face warmed. It had happened so quickly. As the blast of ice and wind and something else surged toward her, Sorsha's scream had been cut off by the door slamming shut. That had probably saved their lives. But all she could think of was getting out of the way. So she'd crouched beneath her table, hands over her head, and prayed. She might have dismissed it as a draft, might have felt foolish, if the prince's eyes hadn't seemed to glow in that moment before the wind and cold, had the glasses on the table not all shattered, had ice not coated the floor, had he not just stayed there untouched. It wasn't possible. The prince. There was a choking, awful sound, and then Dorian was on his knees, peering under the work table.
Sorsha. Sorsha.
She'd gaped at him, unable to find the words. Amethy drummed her long, bony fingers on the wooden desk.
Forgive me for being indelicate, she said.
But Sorsha knew the woman didn't care one bit about manners.
But I'll also remind you that interacting with our patients outside of our duties is prohibited.
There could be no other reason for Prince Dorian to prefer Sorsha's services over Amethy's, of course. Sorsha kept her eyes on her clenched hands in her lap, still flecked with cuts from some of the small shards of glass.
You needn't worry about that, Amethy.
Good. I'd hate to see your position compromised.
His Highness has a reputation with women.
A little smug smile.
And there are many beautiful ladies at this court. And you are not one of them.
Sorsha nodded and took the insult, as she always did and had always done. That was how she survived, how she had remained invisible all these years. It was what she'd promised the prince in the minutes after his explosion, when her shaking ceased, and she'd seen him. Not the magic, but the panic in his eyes, the fear and pain. He wasn't an enemy using forbidden powers, but
a young man in need of help. Her help. She could not turn away from it, from him, could not tell anyone what she'd witnessed. It was what she would have done for anyone else. In the cool, calm voice that she reserved for her most grievously injured patients, she had said to the prince, "I'm not going to tell anyone, but right now, you are going to help me knock this table over, and then you are going to help me clean this up." He'd just stared at her. She stood, noting the hair-thin slices on her hands that had already started stinging. "I am not going to tell anyone," she said again, grabbing one corner of the table. Wordlessly, he went to the other end and helped her ease the table onto its side, the remaining glass and ceramic jars tumbling to the ground. For all the world, it looked like an accident, and Sorsha went to the corner to grab the broom. "When I open this door," she had said to him, still quiet and calm and not quite herself, "we will pretend. But after today, after this..." Dorian stood rigid, as if he were waiting for the blow to fall. "After this," she said, "if you are all right with it, we will try to find ways to keep this from happening. Perhaps there's some tonic to suppress it." His face was still pale.
"I'm sorry," he breathed.
And she knew he meant it. She went to the door and gave him a grim smile. "I will start researching tonight. If I find anything, I'll let you know. And perhaps, not now, but later, if Your Highness has the inclination, you could tell me a bit about how this is possible. It might help me somehow." She didn't give him time to say yes, but instead opened the door, walked back to the mess, and said a little louder than usual, "I am truly sorry, Your Highness. There was something on the floor, and I slipped, and..." From there, it had been easy. The snooping healers had arrived to see what the commotion was about, and one of them had scuttled off to Amethy. The prince had left, and Sorsha had been ordered to wait here. Amethy braced her forearms on the desk. "His Highness was extraordinarily generous, Sorsha. Let it be a lesson for you. You're lucky you didn't injure yourself further."
"I'll make an offering to Silba today," Sorsha lied, quiet and small, and left.
Kaol pressed himself into the darkened alcove of a building, holding his breath as Adian approached the cloaked figure in the alley. Of all the places he'd expected Adian to go when he slipped out of his party at the tavern, the slums were not one of them. Adian had made a spectacular show of playing the generous wild host, buying drinks, saluting his guests, ensuring everyone saw him doing something. And just when no one was looking, Adian had walked right out the front, as if he were too lazy to go to the privy in the back. A staggering drunk, arrogant and careless and haughty. Kaol had almost bought it. Almost. Then Adian had gotten a block away, thrown his hood over his head, and prowled into the night, stone-cold sober. He'd trailed from the shadows as Adian left the wealthier district and strolled into the slums, taking alleys and crooked streets. He could have passed for a wealthy man seeking another sort of woman, until he'd stopped outside this building, and that cloaked figure with the twin blades approached him. Kaol couldn't hear the words between Adian and the stranger, but he could read the tension in their bodies well enough. After a moment, Adian followed the newcomer, though not before he thoroughly scanned the alley, the rooftops, the shadows. Kaol kept his distance. If he caught Adian buying illicit substances, that might be enough to get him to calm down, to keep the parties at a minimum and control the bane when it arrived. Kaol tracked them, mindful of the eyes he passed, every drunk, an orphan, and beggar. On a forgotten street by the Avery's docks, Adian and the cloaked figure slipped into a crumbling building. It wasn't just any building, not with sentries posted on the corner, by the door, on the rooftop, even milling about the street, trying to blend in. They weren't royal guards or soldiers. It wasn't a place to purchase opiates or flesh, either. He'd been memorizing the information Selena had gathered about the rebels, and had stalked them as often as he'd trailed Adian, mostly to no avail. Selena had claimed they'd been looking for a way to defeat the king's power. Larger implications aside, if he could find out not only how the king had stifled magic, but also how to liberate it before he was dragged back to Aniel, then Dorian's secret might be less explosive. It might help him somehow. And Kaol would always help him. His friend. His prince. He couldn't stop a shiver down his spine as he touched the eye of Elena and realized the derelict building, with this pattern of guards, positively reeked of the rebels' habits. Perhaps it wasn't mere coincidence that had led him here. He was so focused on his thundering heart that Kaol didn't have a chance to turn as a dagger pricked his side.
Chapter 19. Kaol didn't put up a fight, though he knew he was as likely to receive death as he was answers. He recognized the sentries by their worn weapons and their fluid, precise movements. He'd never forget those details. Not after he'd spent a day being held prisoner in a warehouse by them, and witnessed Selena cut through them as though they were stalks of wheat. They'd never known that it had been their lost queen who came to slaughter them. The sentries forced him to his knees in an empty room that smelled of old hay. Kaol found Adian and a familiar-looking old man staring down at him. The one who had begged Selena to stop that night in the warehouse. There was nothing remarkable about the old man. His worn clothes were ordinary, his body lean but not yet withered. Beside him stood a young man Kaol knew by his soft, vicious laugh. The guard who had taunted him when he'd been held prisoner. Shoulder-length dark hair hung loose around a face that was more cruel than handsome, especially with the wicked scar slashing through his eyebrow and down his cheek. He dismissed the sentries with a jerk of his chin.
"Well, well," Adian said, circling Kaol.
His sword was out, gleaming in the dim light.
"Captain of the Guard, heir of Aniel,
and spy?
Or has your lover been giving you some tricks of the trade? When you throw parties and convince my men to leave their posts, when you're not at those parties because you're sneaking through the streets, it's my duty to know why, Adian."
The scarred young man with the twin swords stepped closer, circling with Adian now. Two predators sizing up their prey. They'd probably fight over his carcass.
"Too bad your champion isn't here to save you this time," the scarred one said quietly. "Too bad you weren't there to save Archer Finn," Kaol said.
A flare of nostrils, a flash of fury in cunning brown eyes. But the young man fell silent as the old man held out a hand.
"Did the king send you?"
"I came because of him."
Kaol jerked his chin at Adian.
"But I've been looking for you two, and your little group as well. Both of you are in danger. Whatever you think Adian wants, whatever he offers you, the king keeps him on a tight leash."
Perhaps that bit of honesty would buy him what he needed. Trust and information. But Adian barked out a laugh.
"What?"
His companions turned to him, brows raised. Kaol glanced at the ring on the general's finger. He hadn't been mistaken. It was identical to the ones the king, Parrington, and others had worn. Adian caught Kaol's look and stopped his circling. For a moment, The general stared at him, a glimmer of surprise and amusement darting across his tan face. Then Adian purred. You've turned out to be a far more interesting man than I thought, Captain.
Explain, Adian,
the old man said softly, but not weakly. Adian smiled broadly as he yanked the black ring off his finger. The day the king presented me with the Sword of Orinth, he also offered me a ring. Thanks to my heritage, my senses are sharper. I thought the ring smelled strange, and knew only a fool would accept that kind of gift from him. So I had a replica made. The real one I chucked into the sea. But I always wondered what it did, he mused, tossing the ring with one hand and catching it. It seems the captain knows and disapproves. The man with the twin swords ceased his circling, and the grin he gave Kaol was nothing short of feral.
You're right, Adian,
he said without taking his eyes off Kaol.
He is more interesting than he seems.
Adian pocketed the ring as if it were. As if it were indeed a fake. And Kaol realized that he'd revealed far more than he'd ever intended. Adian began circling again, the scarred young man echoing the graceful movements.
A magical leash, when there is no magic left, the general mused.
And yet you still followed me, believing I was under the king's spell. Thinking you could use me to win the rebels' favor? Fascinating. Kaol kept his mouth shut. He'd already said enough to damn himself. Adian went on. These two said your assassin friend was a rebel sympathizer, that she handed over information to Archer Finn without thinking twice, that she allowed rebels to sneak out of the city when she was commanded to put them down. Was she the one who told you about the king's rings? Or did you discover that tidbit all on your own? What exactly is going on in that glass palace when the king isn't looking? Kaol clamped down on his retort. When it became clear he wouldn't speak, Adian shook his head. You know how this has to end, Adian said. And there wasn't anything mocking in it. Just cold calculation. The true face of the Northern Wolf. The way I see it, you signed your own death warrant when you decided to trail me. And now that you know so much. You have two options, Captain. We can torture it out of you and then we'll kill you. Or you can tell us what you know and we'll make it quick for you. As painless as possible. On my honor. They stopped circling. Kaol had faced death a few times in the past few months. Had faced and seen and dealt it. But this death, where Selena and Dorian and his mother would never know what happened to him, it disgusted him somehow, enraged him. Adian stepped closer to where Kaol knelt. He could take out the scarred one, then hope he could stand against Adian, or at least flee. He would fight, because that was the only way he could embrace this sort of death. Adian's sword was at the ready, the sword that belonged to Selena by blood and right. Kaol had assumed he was a two-faced butcher. Adian was a traitor, but not to Terrasen. Adian had been playing a very dangerous game since arriving here, since his kingdom fell 10 years ago. And tricking the king into thinking that he'd been wearing his ring all this time. That was indeed information Adian would be willing to kill to keep safe. Yet there was other information Kaol could use, perhaps, to get out of this alive. Regardless of how shattered she'd been when she left, Selena was safe now. She was away from Otterlin. But Dorian, with his magic, with the threat he secretly posed, was not. Adian took a readying breath to kill him. keeping Dorian protected was all he had left, all that had ever really mattered. If these rebels did indeed know something, anything, about magic that might help to free it, if he could use Adian to get that information. It was a gamble, the biggest gamble he'd ever made. Adian raised his sword. With a silent prayer for forgiveness, Kaol looked straight at Adian.
Aelin is alive.
Adian Ashriver had been called wolf, general, prince, traitor, and murderer. And he was all of those things, and more. Liar, deceiver, and trickster were his particular favorites, the titles only those closest to him knew. Otterlin's whore, that's what the ones who didn't know him called him. It was true. In so many ways it was true. And he had never minded it. Not really. It had allowed him to maintain control in the north, to keep the bloodshed down to a minimum and a lie. Half the Bane were rebels, and the other half sympathizers. So many of their battles in the north had been staged. The body count a deceit and an exaggeration. At least, once the corpses got up from the killing field under cover of darkness and went home to their families. Otterlin's whore. He had not minded. Until now. Cousin. That had been his most beloved title. Cousin, kin, protector. Those were the secret names he harbored deep within. The names he whispered to himself when the northern wind was shrieking through the staghorns. Sometimes that wind sounded like the screams of his people being led to the butchering blocks. And sometimes it sounded like Aelin. Aelin, whom he had loved, who should have been his queen, and to whom he would have one day sworn the blood oath. Adian stood on the decaying planks of an empty dock in the slums, staring at the Avery. The captain was beside him, spitting blood into the water thanks to the beating given to him by Ren Alsbrook, Adian's newest conspirator and yet another dead man risen from the grave. Ren, heir and lord of Alsbrook, had trained with Adian as a child, and had once been his rival. 10 years ago, Ren and his grandfather Murtaug had escaped the butchering blocks thanks to a diversion started by Ren's parents that cost them their lives and gave Ren the nasty scar down his face. But Adian hadn't known. He'd thought them dead, and had been stunned to learn that they were the secret rebel group he'd hunted down upon arriving in Rifthold. He'd heard the claims that Aelin was alive and raising an army, and had dragged himself down from the north to get to the bottom of it and destroy the liars, preferably cutting them up piece by piece. The king's summons had been a convenient excuse. Ren and Murtaug had instantly admitted that the rumors had been spread by a former member of their rebel group. They had never had or heard of any contact with their dead queen. But seeing Ren and Murtaug, he'd since wondered who else might have survived. He had never allowed himself to hope that Aelin. Adian set his sword on the wooden rail and ran his scarred fingers down it, taking in the nicks and lines, each mark a tale of legendary battles fought, of great kings long dead. The sword was the last shred of proof that a mighty kingdom had once existed in the north. It wasn't his sword, not really. In those initial days of blood and conquest, the King of Otterlin had snatched the blade from Roe Galathinius's cooling body and brought it to Rifthold. And there it had stayed, the sword that should have been Aelin's. So Adian had fought for years in those war camps and battlefields, fought to prove his invaluable worth to the king, and had taken everything that was done to him again and again. When he and the Bane won that first battle, and the king had proclaimed him the Northern Wolf and offered him a boon, Adian had asked for the sword. The king attributed the request to an 18-year-old's romanticism, and Adian had swaggered about his own glory until everyone believed that he was a traitorous, butchering bastard, who made a mockery of the sword just by touching it. But winning back the sword didn't erase his failure. Even though he'd been 13, and even though he'd been 40 miles away in Orinth when Aelin had been killed on the country estate, he should have stopped it. He'd been sent to her land upon his mother's death to become Aelin's sword and shield, to serve in the court she was supposed to have ruled, that child of kings. So he should have ridden out when the castle erupted with the news that Orlan Galathinius had been assassinated. By the time anyone did, Roe, Evelyn, and Aelin were dead. It was that reminder he'd carried with him on his back. The reminder of who the sword belonged to, and to whom, when he took his last breath and went to the other world, he'd finally give it. But now the sword, that weight he'd embraced for years, felt lighter and sharper, far more fragile, infinitely precious. The world had slipped from beneath his feet. No one had spoken for a moment after the captain of the guard made his claim. Aelin is alive. Then the captain had said he'd only speak with Adian about it. Just to show they weren't bluffing about torturing him, Wren had bloodied him up with a cool precision that Adian grudgingly admired. But the captain had taken the blows. And whenever Wren paused, Murtaugh looked on disapprovingly. The captain said the same thing. After it became clear that the captain would either tell only Adian or die, he'd called off Wren. The heir of Alsbrook bristled, but Adian had dealt with plenty of young men like him in the war camps. It never took much to get them to fall in line. Adian gave him a long, hard stare, and Wren backed down. Which was how they wound up here, Kaol cleaning off his face with a scrap of his shirt. For the past few minutes, Adian had listened to the most unlikely story he'd ever heard. The story of Selena Sardothian, the infamous assassin, being trained by Aerobin Hommel. The story of her downfall and year in Endovir, and how she'd wound up in the ridiculous competition to become the king's champion. The story of Aelin, his queen, in a death camp, and then serving in her enemy's house. Adian braced his hands on the rail. It couldn't be true. Not after 10 years. 10 years without hope. Without proof.
She has your eyes,
Kaol said, working his jaw. If this assassin, an assassin, gods above, was truly Aelin, then she was the king's champion. Then she was the captain's...
You sent her to Wendlin,
Adian said, his voice ragged. The tears would come later. Right now he was emptied, gutted. Every lie, every rumor and act and party he'd thrown, every battle real or faked, every life he'd taken so more could live. How would he ever explain that to her? Otterlin's whore.
I didn't know who she was. I just thought she would be safer there because of what she is. You realize you've only given me a bigger reason to kill you.
Adian clenched his jaw.
Do you have any idea what kind of risk you took in telling me? I could be working for the king. You thought I was enthralled to him, and all you had for proof against it was a quick story. You might as well have killed her yourself.
Fool. Stupid, reckless fool. But the captain still had the upper hand here. The king's noble captain, who was now towing the line of treason. He'd wondered about the captain's allegiance when Wren told him about the involvement of the king's champion with the rebels, but... Damn. Aelin. Aelin was the king's champion. Aelin had helped the rebels and gutted Archer Finn. His knees threatened to buckle, but he swallowed the shock, the surprise and terror and glimmer of delight.
I know it was a risk, the captain said. But the men who have those rings, something changes in their eyes, a kind of darkness that sometimes manifests physically. I haven't seen it in you since you've been here, and I've never seen someone throw so many parties but only attend for a few minutes. You wouldn't go to such lengths to hide your meetings with the rebels if you were enslaved to the king, especially when during all this time the Bane still hasn't come, despite your assurances that it will be here soon. It doesn't add up.
The captain met his stare. Perhaps not quite a fool, then.
I think she'd want you to know.
The captain looked down the river toward the sea.
This place reeked.
Adian had smelled and seen worse in war camps, but the slums of Rifthold certainly gave them a run for their money. And Terrasen's capital, Orinth, its once shining tower, now a slab of filthy white stone, was well on its way to falling into this level of poverty and despair. But maybe, someday soon. Aelin was alive. Alive and as much of a killer as he was, and working for the same man.
Does the prince know?
He'd never been able to speak with the prince without remembering the days before Terrasen's downfall. He'd never been able to hide that hatred.
No. He doesn't even know why I sent her to Wendlin. Or that she's... you're both... Fae.
Adian had never possessed a fraction of the power that had smoldered in her veins, which had burned libraries and caused such general worry that there had been talk, in those months before the world went to hell, of sending her somewhere so that she could learn to control it. He'd overheard debate over packing her off to various academies or tutors in distant lands, but never to their Aunt Maeve, waiting like a spider in a web to see what became of her niece. And yet she'd wound up in Wendlin, on her aunt's doorstep. Maeve had either never known or never cared about his inherited gifts. No, all he had were some of the physical traits of their immortal kin. Strength, swiftness, sharp hearing, keen smell. It had made him a formidable opponent on the battlefield, and saved his life more than once. Saved his very soul if the captain was right about those rings.
Is she coming back?
Adian asked quietly. The first of the many, many questions he had for the captain, now that he'd proved himself to be more than a useless servant of the king. There was enough agony in the captain's eyes that Adian knew that he loved her. Knew, and felt a tug of jealousy, if only because the captain knew her that well.
I don't know,
Kaol admitted. If he hadn't been his enemy, Adian would have respected the man for the sacrifice implied. But Aelin had to come back. She would come back. Unless that return only earned her a walk to the butchering block. He would sort through each wild thought when he was alone. He gripped the damp rail harder, fighting the urge to ask more. But then the captain gave him a weighing look, as if he could see through every mask Adian had ever worn. For a heartbeat, Adian considered putting the blade right through the captain and dumping his body in the Avery, despite the information he possessed. The captain glanced at the blade, too, and Adian wondered if he was thinking the same thing, regretting his decision to trust him. The captain should regret it, should curse himself for a fool. Adian said,
"Why were you tracking the rebels?"
"Because I thought they might have valuable information."
It had to be truly valuable, then, if he'd risk revealing himself as a traitor to get it. Adian had been willing to torture the captain, to kill him, too. He'd done worse before. But torturing and killing his queen's lover wouldn't go over well if... when she returned. And the captain was now his greatest source of information.
He wanted to know more about Aelin, about her plans, about what she was like and how he could find her. He wanted to know everything, anything, especially where the captain now stood on the game board, and what the captain knew about the king. So Adian said, "Tell me more about those rings." But the captain shook his head. "I want to make a bargain with you."
Chapter 20. The black eye was still gruesome, but it improved over the next week as Selena worked in the kitchens, tried and failed to shift with Rowan, and generally avoided everyone. The spring rains had come to stay, and the kitchen was packed every night. So Selena took to eating dinner on the shadowed steps, arriving just before the storykeeper began speaking. Storykeeper. That's what Emrys was, a title of honor amongst both Fae and humans in Wendlin. What it meant was that when he began telling a story, you sat down and shut up. It also meant that he was a walking library of the kingdom's legends and myths. By that time, Selena knew most of the fortress's residents, if only in the sense that she could put names to faces. She'd observed them out of instinct, to learn her surroundings, her potential enemies and threats. She knew they observed her, too, when they thought she wasn't paying attention. And any shred of regret she felt at not approaching them was burned up by the fact that no one bothered to approach her, either. The only person who made an effort was Luca, who still peppered Selena with questions as they worked, still prattled on and on about his training, the fortress gossip, the weather. He'd only talked to her once about anything else. On a morning when it had taken a monumental effort to peel herself out of bed, and only the scar on her palm had made her plant her feet on the icy floor, she'd been washing the breakfast dishes, staring out the window without seeing anything, too heavy in her bones. When Luca had dumped a pot in the sink and quietly said,
"For a long while, I couldn't talk about what happened to me before I came here. There were some days I couldn't talk at all. Couldn't get out of bed, either. But if, when you need to talk..."
She'd shut him down with a long look, and he hadn't said anything like it since. Thankfully, Emrys gave her space. Lots of space, especially when Malachi arrived during breakfast to make sure Selena hadn't caused any trouble. She usually avoided looking at the other fortress couples. But here, where she couldn't walk away, she hated their closeness, the way Malachi's eyes lit up every time he saw him. Hated it so much that she choked on it. She never asked Rowan why he, too, came to hear Emrys's stories. As far as they were each concerned, the other didn't exist outside of training. Training was a generous way to describe what they were doing, as she had accomplished nothing. She didn't shift once. He snarled and sneered and hissed, but she couldn't do it. Every day, always when Rowan disappeared for a few moments, she tried, but nothing. Rowan threatened to drag her back to the barrows, as that seemed to be the only thing that had triggered any sort of response. But he'd backed off, to her surprise, when she told him that she'd slit her own throat before entering that place again. So they swore at each other, sat in brooding silence on the temple ruin, and occasionally had those unspoken shouting matches. If she was in a particularly nasty mood, he made her chop wood, log after log, until she could hardly lift the axe and her hands were blistered. If she was going to be pissed off at the whole damn world, he said, if she was going to waste his time by not shifting, then she might as well be useful in some way. All this waiting. For her. For the shift that made her shudder to think about. It was on the 8th day after her arrival, after scrubbing pots and pans until her back throbbed, that Selena stopped in the middle of their hike up the now familiar ridge. "I have a request." She never spoke to him unless she needed to, mostly to curse at him. Now, she said, I want to see you shift.
A blink, those green eyes flat.
You don't have the privilege of giving orders.
Show me how you do it.
Her memories of the Fae and Terrasen were foggy, as if someone had smeared oil over them. She couldn't remember seeing one of them change, where their clothes had gone, how fast it had been. He stared her down, seeming to say, just this once, and then a soft flash of light, a ripple of color, and a hawk was flapping midair, beating for the nearest tree branch. He settled on it, clicking his beak. She scanned the mossy earth. No sign of his clothes, his weapons. It had taken barely more than a few heartbeats. He gave a battle cry and swooped, talons slashing for her eyes. She lunged behind the tree just as there was another flash and a shudder of color. And then he was clothed and armed and growling in her face.
Your turn.
She wouldn't give him the satisfaction of seeing her tremble. It was incredible. Incredible to see the shift. Where do your clothes go?
Between somewhere. I don't particularly care.
Such dead, joyless eyes. She had a feeling she looked like that these days. She knew she had looked like that the night Kaol had caught her gutting Archer in the tunnel. What had left Rowan so soulless? He bared his teeth, but she didn't submit. She'd been watching the Demi-Fae warrior males at the fortress, and they growled and showed their teeth about everything. They were not the ethereal gentlefolk that legend painted, that she vaguely remembered from Terrasen. No holding hands and dancing around the maypole with flowers in their hair. They were predators, the lot of them. Some of the dominant females were just as aggressive, prone to snarling when challenged or annoyed or even hungry. She supposed she might have fit in with them if she'd bothered to try. Still holding Rowan's stare, Selena calmed her breathing. She imagined phantom fingers reaching down, pulling her fae form out. Imagined a wash of color and light. Pushed herself against her mortal flesh, but nothing. Sometimes I wonder whether this is a punishment for you, she said through her teeth. But what could you have done to piss off her immortal majesty?
Don't use that tone when you talk about her.
Oh, I can use whatever tone I want. And you can taunt and snarl at me and make me chop wood all day. But short of ripping out my tongue, you can't... Faster than lightning, his hand shot out and she gagged, jolting as he grabbed her tongue between her fingers. She bit down, hard. But he didn't let go.
Say that again,
he purred. She choked as he kept pinching her tongue, and she went for his daggers, simultaneously slamming her knee up between his legs, but he shoved his body against hers, a wall of hard muscle and several hundred years of lethal training trapping her against a tree. She was a joke by comparison. A joke. And her tongue. He released her tongue, and she gasped for breath. She swore at him, a filthy, foul name, and spat at his feet. And that's when he bit her. She cried out as those canines pierced the spot between her neck and shoulder, a primal act of aggression, the bite so strong and claiming that she was too stunned to move. He had her pinned against the tree and clamped down harder, his canines digging deep, her blood spilling onto her shirt. Pinned like some weakling. But that was what she'd become, wasn't it? Useless. Pathetic. She growled, more animal than sentient being, and shoved. Rowan staggered back a step, teeth ripping her skin as she struck his chest. She didn't feel the pain, didn't care about the blood or the flash of light. No,
She wanted to rip his throat out, rip it out with the elongated canines she bared at him, as she finished shifting and roared.
Chapter 21. Rowan grinned.
There you are.
Blood. Her blood was on his teeth, on his mouth and chin. And those dead eyes glowed as he spat her blood onto the earth. She probably tasted like a sewer to him. There was a shrieking in her ears, and Selena lunged at him. Lunged, and then stopped, as she took in the world with stunning clarity. Smelled it, and tasted it, and breathed it like the finest wine. Gods, this place, this kingdom smelled divine, smelled like... She had shifted. She panted, even though her lungs were telling her she was no longer winded and did not need as many breaths in this body. There was a tickling at her neck. Her skin slowly began to stitch itself together. She was a faster healer in this form, because of the magic. Breathe, breathe. But there it was, rising up, wildfire crackling in her veins, in her fingertips, the forest around them so much kindling. And then, she shoved back, took the fear and used it like a battering ram inside herself, against the power, shoving it down, down. Rowan prowled closer.
Let it out. Don't fight it.
A pulse beat against her, nipping, smelling of snow and pine. Rowan's power, taunting hers. Not like her fire, but a gift of ice and wind. A freezing zap at her elbow had her falling back against the tree. The magic bit her cheek now. Magic, attacking her. The wildfire exploded in a wall of blue flame, rushing for Rowan, engulfing the trees, the world, herself, until it vanished, sucked out into nothing, along with the air she was breathing. Selena dropped to her knees, as she clutched at her neck as if she could claw open an airway for herself. Rowan's boots appeared in the field of her vision. He'd pulled the air out, suffocated her fire. Such power, such control. Maeve had not given her an instructor with similar abilities. She'd instead sent someone with power capable of smothering her fire, someone who wouldn't mind doing it should she become a threat. Air rushed down her throat in a whoosh. She gasped it down in greedy gulps, hardly registering the agony as she shifted back into her mortal form. The world going quiet and dull again.
Does your lover know what you are?
A cold question. She lifted her head, not caring how he'd found out. He knows everything. Not entirely true. His eyes flickered. With what emotion, she couldn't tell.
I won't be biting you again,
he said. And she wondered just what he'd tasted in her blood. She growled, but the sound was muted, fangless. Even if it's the only way to get me to shift? He walked uphill, to the ridge.
You don't bite the women of other males.
She heard, more than felt, something die from her voice, as she said, We're not together. Not anymore. I let him go before I came here. He looked over his shoulder.
Why?
Flat. Bored. But still slightly curious. What did she care if he knew? She'd curled her hand into a fist in her lap, her knuckles white. Every time she glanced at the ring, rubbed it, caught it gleaming, it punched a hole right through her. She should take the damn thing off. But she knew she wouldn't, if only because that near-constant agony felt deserved.
because he's safer if he's as repulsed by me as you are.
At least you've already learned one lesson.
When she cocked her head, he said,
"The people you love are just weapons that will be used against you."
She didn't want to recall how Nehemia had been used.
Had used herself.
Against her, to force her to act. Wanted to pretend she wasn't starting to forget what Nehemia had looked like.
"Shift again," Rowan ordered, jerking his chin at her. "This time, try to..."
She was forgetting what Nehemia looked like. The shade of her eyes, the curve of her lips, the smell of her, her laugh. The roaring in Selena's head went quiet, silenced by that familiar nothingness.
"Do not let that light go out."
But Selena didn't know how to stop it. The one person she could have told, who might have understood. She was buried in an unadorned grave, so far from the sun-warmed soil that she had loved. Rowan gripped her by the shoulders.
"Are you listening?"
She gave him a bored stare, even as his fingers dug into her skin. "Why don't you just bite me again?"
"Why don't I give you the lashing you deserve?"
He looked so dead set on it that she blinked.
"If you ever take a whip to me, I will skin you alive."
He let go of her and stalked around the clearing, a predator assessing its prey.
"If you don't shift again, you're pulling double duty in the kitchens for the next week."
Fine. At least working in the kitchens had some quantifiable results. At least in the kitchens, she could tell up from down and knew what she was doing. But this? This promise she'd made? The bargain she'd struck with Maeve? She'd been a fool. Rowan paused his stalking.
"You're worthless."
"Tell me something I don't know." He went on.
"You would probably have been more useful to the world if you'd actually died 10 years ago."
She just looked him in the eye and said, "I'm leaving." Rowan didn't stop her as she returned to the fortress and packed. It took all of a minute, as she hadn't even unloaded her satchel and had no weapons left. She supposed she could have ripped the fortress apart to find where Rowan had stashed them, or stolen them from the demi-fay, but both would require time and bring more attention than she wanted. She didn't talk to anyone as she walked out. She'd find another way to learn about the word keys and destroy the King of Otterlin and free Eelway. If she kept going like this, she'd have nothing left inside to fight with. She'd marked the paths they'd taken on the way in. But as she entered the tree-covered slopes, she mostly relied on the position of the cloud-veiled sun to navigate. She'd make the trip back, find food along the way, and figure out something else. This had been a fool's errand from the start. At least she hadn't been too long delayed, though she might now have to be quicker about finding the answers she needed and...
"Is this what you do? Run away when things get hard?"
Rowan was standing between two trees directly in her path, having undoubtedly flown here. She brushed past him, her legs burning with the downhill walk. "You're free of your obligation to train me, so I have nothing more to say to you, and you have nothing more to say to me. Do us both a favor and go to hell." A growl.
"Have you ever had to fight for anything in your life?"
She let out a low, bitter laugh and walked faster, veering westward, not caring about the direction as much as getting away from him. But he kept up easily, his long, heavily muscled legs devouring the mossy ground.
"You're proving me right with every step you take."
"I don't care."
"I don't know what you want from Maeve, what answers you're looking for, but you..."
"You don't know what I want from her?" It was more of a shout than a question. "How about saving the world from the King of Otterlin?"
"Why bother? Maybe the world's not worth saving."
She knew he meant it, too. Those lifeless eyes spoke volumes.
Because I made a promise. A promise to my friend that I would see her kingdom freed.
She shoved her scarred palm into his face.
I made an unbreakable vow. And you, and Maeve, and all you goddamned bastards are getting in the way of that.
She went off down the hillside again. He followed.
And what of your own people? What of your own kingdom?
They are better off without me, just as you said.
His tattoo scrunched as he snarled.
So you'd save another land, but not yours. Why can't your friend save her own kingdom?
Because she is dead!
She screamed the last word so loudly it burned in her throat.
Because she is dead, and I am left with my worthless life.
He merely stared at her with that animal stillness. When she walked away, he didn't come after her. She lost track of how far she walked and in what direction she traveled. She didn't really care. She hadn't spoken the words, "She is dead," since the day after Nehemia had been taken from her. But she was dead, and Selena missed her. Night swept in earlier due to the cloud cover, the temperature plummeting as thunder grumbled in the distance. She made weapons as she went, finding a sharp stone to whittle down branches into rudimentary spears. The longer one she used as a walking stick, and though they were little more than stakes, she told herself the two short ones were daggers. Better than nothing. Each step was heavier than the last, and she had enough of a sense of self-preservation left to start looking for a place to spend the night. It was almost dark when she found a decent spot. A shallow cave in the side of a granite ledge. She swiftly gathered enough wood for a fire. The irony of it wasn't wasted on her. If she had any control over her magic... She shut down that thought before it finished. She hadn't made a fire in years, so it took a few tries, but it worked. Just as thunder cracked above her little cave and the skies opened up. She was hungry, and thankfully found some apples at the bottom of her satchel, along with old tegya from Verez that was still edible, if hard to chew. After she ate as much of it as she could stand, she pulled her cloak around herself and nestled into the side of the cave. She didn't fail to notice the small, glowing eyes that gathered, peering through the brambles or over boulders or around trees. None of them had bothered her since that first night, and they didn't come closer. Her instincts, warped as they had felt these last few weeks, didn't raise any alarms either. So she didn't tell them off, and didn't really mind them at all. With the fire and the pounding rain, it was almost cozy, not like her freezing room. Though she was exhausted, she felt somewhat clear-headed, almost like herself again with her makeshift weapons. She'd made a smart choice to leave. Do what needs to be done, Elena had told her. Well, she'd needed to leave before Rowan shredded her into so many pieces that she would never stand a chance of putting herself back together. Tomorrow, she'd start over. She'd spotted what looked like a crumbling, forgotten road that she could follow downhill. As long as she kept going toward the plains, she could find her way back to the coast and come up with a new plan as she went. It was good she had left. Exhaustion hit her so thoroughly that she was asleep moments after she sprawled beside the fire, one hand clasped around her spear. She probably would have dozed until dawn, had a sudden silence not jerked her awake. Chapter 22 Selena's fire was still crackling, the rain still pounding beyond the cave mouth. But the forest had gone quiet. Those little watching eyes had vanished. She uncoiled to her feet,
spear in one hand and a stake in the other, and crept to the narrow cave entrance. With the rain and the fire, she couldn't make out anything.